Chapter 17. Rogue Star. Dr. Savine, Cora, and Mr. Horn. In the Annex. Even at full warp, it took the SN 30 weeks to reach Kincheir. True, we took a circuitous route, avoiding all possible encounters with the forces of the Imperium. I hated that. For once, I hated the subterfuge. We learned, indirectly, a few weeks into the voyage, that my escape from Cadia had been discovered. The Inquisition and other agencies were hunting me. I had been formally declared heretic and extremis diabolus. Lord Rawkin had finally countersigned Osmer's Carta. I was now something I had never been before. A fugitive, a renegade. And in aiding me, my band of comrades had made themselves fugitives, too. We had a few scrapes. Refueling at Malid, we were discovered and pursued by an unidentified warship which we lost in the Imperium. At Avignon, a squadron of Ecclesiarchy battleboats, standing picket watch along the border of the diocese, tried to run us to ground. We only escaped that one thanks to a combination of Maxilla's shipcraft and Medea's fighting nous. On Trexia Beta, Nail and Fischig ran across a band of Arbites hunters while they were trying to hire an astropath. They never told me how many they had been forced to kill, but it sat badly with them for weeks. On Anima Gulf Ward, Bequin succeeded in obtaining the services of an astropath, a sickly female called Tashira Ungish. When Ungish found out who I was, she begged to be returned to her backwater world. It took a long time to convince her that she was in no danger from me. I had to open my mind to her in the end. At Oetstar, we were discovered by an Inquisitor Frontal during a resupply layover. As it was with Rigri and the Cadian pilots, I will always be haunted by those necessary deaths. I tried to reason with Frontal. I tried very hard. A young man, he believed that taking me down was the key to a famous career. Eisenhorn the Heretic, he kept calling me. They were the last words on his lips when I pitched him into the geothermal heating exchanger. From Trexia Beta onwards, there was an almost permanent rumour that a kill team of the Grey Knights was hunting us, and the Death Watch Chapter 2. I prayed to my God Emperor that I could complete this task before the forces of righteousness overtook me, and I prayed to him that my friends might be spared. Between those escapades, there were only the long, slow weeks of transit in the deep warp. I filled my time with study and with weapons practice with Nail, Fischig, or Medea. I battled to get myself healthy again. The Carnificina had wasted me, both in body and spirit. The weight I had lost would simply not go back on, despite Maxilla's generous banquets. And I felt slow. Slow with a blade, slow on my feet. Slow and clumsy with a gun. Even my mind was slow. I began to fear that Osmer had broken me. Tessera Ungish was a semi-paralyzed woman in her 50s. The arduous rituals of the warp had left her broken and all but burned out, consigned to a life as a junior telepath in the class chambers of Anima Gulfwood. Her raddled body was supported by an augmetic exoskeleton. I believe she might have been beautiful once, but her face was now hollow and her hair thin where the implant plugs of her calling had been sighted.
"That time again, heretic?"
she asked as I walked into her quarters. This was about the 20th week of the voyage. "I wish you wouldn't call me that," I said.
"Coping strategy," she purred. "Your woman Bequin connived me out of a safe life on Anima Gulfwood and made me party to a heretic's private crusade."
"A safe life, Ungish. A bad end. You'd have been dead in another 6 months, the strain of the traffic they were making you process." She tutted, her augmetic chassis whirring as she poured us two glasses of Amasek. Hers was laced with phyto-barrier enhancers, and her room stank of low leaf. I knew the rigours of her life had left her in constant pain, and she fought that pain off with everything she could lay her hands on.
"Dead and buried on Anima Gulfwood in 6, or dead in agony in your service?"
"It's not like that," I said, nodding as I took the glass she proffered.
"Is it not?"
"No. I've let you see my mind. You know the purity of my cause." She frowned.
"Maybe."
She was having difficulty manipulating her own glass. The mechadendrites that governed her right hand were old and slow. She waved me off when I tried to help. "Maybe?" I asked. She took a big swig of her drink and then poked a low stick between her crinkled lips.
"I've seen your mind, heretic. You're not as clean as you like to think you are."
I sat down on the chaise. "Am I not?" She lit the low-stick and exhaled a deep lungful of its narcotic smoke with a sigh.
Ah, don't mind me. A ruined, worn-out psyker who talks too much.
I'm interested. What do you see? Her exoskeleton made soft whines as it walked her over to the other couch, and the hydraulics hissed as they settled her into the seat. She took another deep puff.
I'm sorry, she said. Would you like one?
I shook my head.
I have served the Astropathicus all my life, such as it is, on guild tenure and as a freelance, as now. When your woman came to me with a job offer and real money, I took it. But oh me, oh my.
Astropaths are supposed to be neutral, I countered.
Astropaths are supposed to serve the Emperor, heretic, she said.
What have you seen in my mind? I asked, bluntly.
Too much, she responded,
blowing a magnificent smoke ring. Tell me. She shook her head, or that's what I suppose the hissing action of her head cage was supposed to convey.
I suppose I should be grateful. You took me from a dead life to this.
An adventure. I don't need you to be grateful, I said.
Dead and buried on Anima Gulfwood in six, or dead in agony in your service, she repeated.
It won't be like that. She blew another smoke ring.
Oh, it will. I've seen it. Clear as day.
You have?
Many times. I'm going to die because of you, heretic.
Ungish was stubborn and defeatist. I knew she had seen things she wouldn't talk about. Eventually, I stopped asking. We met every few days, and she psychometrically captured images from my mind. The Cadian pylons, Cherubael, profanity, and the ornaments he wore. By the time we reached King Chair, I had a sheaf of psychometric pictures and, thanks to the crippled astropath, a grim sense of the future. King Chair, a mineral rock orbiting a rogue star. Plagued by gravitic storms, the Kincher system wanders sloppily through the fringes of the halo stars at the edge of imperial space. 10,000 years ago, it had been a neighbor of 3458 Dornal, and had 9 planets and an asteroid belt. When we finally found it, it was lurching through the Pimbile systems, major and minor, and had suffered 2 serious cosmological collisions. Now it had 6 planets and radiating sheets of asteroid belts. Kincher's rogue star was locked in a drunken dance with Pimbile Minor, a flirtatious encounter of gravities that would take another 1,000,000 years to resolve. Kincher itself, or more properly, Kincher Rogue System Stroke Planet 4, X181b, was a blue nugget of rock swaggering along an almost figure-8 far orbit around the clashing stars, following the vagaries of their impacting gravity wells. Rich in ultra-rare metals, including ansilitum and feridinum, it had been a miner's plunder haven for as long as it had been identified.
No watch ships. Precious little in the way of guidance, boys,
Maxilla said as he steered the SN in-system.
I've got a habitation hotspot. The mining colony, I'll bet.
Park us in orbit, I told him. Medea, fire up the cutter for landfall. Amos, you're with me.
Whoa,
whispered Medea, tightening the grip of her circuit-inlaid hands around the biosensors of the cutter's steering yoke. Another hard buffet had shaken the craft.
The gravity tides are all over the place. I keep hitting eddies and anti-Trojan points. Small wonder,
Amos muttered, easing himself into a deck seat and connecting the restraint harness across his lap.
The rogue star and its planet herd have made a disaster area of this system.
Said Medea, showing no concern as she rolled the cutter up and over on its back to avoid a jagged black asteroid that tumbled across our path. The close approach to Kincher was a debris field, full of rock matter and collision slag, all swirling around in complex and exotic orbits. Parts of this field had formed into thin ring systems around Kincher, but even the rings were buckled and warped by gravity clashes. The space around us was a bright misty gold, where starlight was catching the banks of dust and micro-litter. The cutter's shields could handle most of the larger rocks that swirled through it, but some were giants and required evasive manoeuvres. Through the gold dustlight, we began to see Kincher more clearly, an irregular, glittered blue object spinning fast along a stricken axis. It was half in shadow, and the peaks of its mineral mountains made pre-dawn flashes as they caught the early light coming up over the daylight terminator.
The closer we get to the body, the worse the gravitic disturbances will become, of course.
Amos mused aloud. Medea didn't need the advice. Even I knew that an irregular body, and especially an irregular body composed of varying densities, would have a near-space lousy with abnormal gravity effects. I think Amos was just chatting to keep his mind off things. Medea banked us around the searing trails of three bolides, and into what felt like a chute of high gravity. Kincher's surface, a revolving, pitted, cold expanse, rushed up to meet us and filled the main ports. The descent and proximity alarms started to sound, and Medea killed them both with an impatient sideways stab of her hand. We leveled out a little.
The mining facility beacons just woke up.
Medea cleared her throat.
I've got a pre-lock telemetry handshake. They're requesting ident.
Give it. Medea activated the cutter's transponder and broadcast our craft's identifying pulse. It was one of the disguise templates we stored in the codifier for covert work, a delicate piece of fakery designed by Medea and Maxilla. According to its signature, we were a research team from the Royal Scolum Geologicus on Mendelin.
They've cleared us to touch,
Medea reported, easing us past another buffet of gravity turbulence.
They've activated the guide pathway.
Any Vox contact?
She shook her head. It could all be mechanical.
Take us in. Kincher Minehead was a cluster of old industrial structures plugging the cone of an upthrust impact event. Flight approach was down a rill in the crater edge. The buildings seemed at first sight to be rude and unfinished, rough-hewn from the blue rock, but I quickly realized they were standard Imperial modular structures caked with accretions of blue dust and gypnet. As far as records showed, Kincher Minehead had been here for 900 years. We sat down on a cleared hardpan surrounded by serially winking marker lamps. The braking jets kicked up a swirling halo of alluvium into the airless sky. After a short wait, two monotask servitors, heavy-grade units on caterpillar tracks, emerged into the hard starlight from the shadows of a docking barn, attached clamps to our front end, and silently towed us back into the barn. It was a grim place of dirty bare metal and lifting gear. Two battered prospector pods sat in berthing bays, and in the gloom at the far end was a cargo shuttle that had seen better days. The barn doors closed behind us, and flashing hazard lamps in the berthing dock moved from amber to green as the atmosphere was cycled back in. Apart from the servitors, there was no sign of life.
Cutter systems show green on outside conditions, said Medea, swinging out of her seat.
Are we ready? I asked.
Sure,
said Medea. She had switched her regular Glavian pilot's gear, with its distinctive cerise jacket, for a much more anonymous set of grubby flight overalls. Heavy, tan and baggy, they were actually the quilted liner of an armored void suit. The surface was covered in eyelets, laces, and stud connectors where the armor segments would lock on, and there were umbilical sockets in the chest. Medea had removed the helmet ring and allowed the heavy collar to hang open. She wore work gloves and steel-capped military boots and tucked her hair up under a billed cap with the Imperial Eagle on the front. Amos had adjusted the hydraulic settings of his augmetic exoskeleton to hold him in the stiffest, most upright stance possible. With a long tunic cloak of black Bagheera, a white skullcap, and an engraved data cane, he looked every centimetre a distinguished Scolam academic. I lacked any trace of my usual inquisitorial garb. I wore leather breeches and high buckled boots, an old flak armour jerkin with dirty ceramite overplates, and a full-face filter mask with tinted eyelets that resembled nothing so much as a snarling skull. Nail had lent me a motion tracker unit from his personal kit, which I had strapped over my right shoulder, and a heavy, snub-nosed las pistol that hung in an armpit rig under my jerkin. A combat shotgun rested in a scabbard between my shoulder blades, and I had a belt of shells for it around my waist. I looked and felt like hired thug muscle, which was precisely the point. Medea popped the hatch, and we descended into the barn. It was cold, and the air was parched from too many automatic scrubbings. Odd mechanical noises sounded sporadically in the distance. Squat, short-based servitors were busy tinkering with the old shuttle's exposed engine guts. We clanged up the grill stairs to the interior hatch. It was marked with a bas-relief symbol of the Adeptus Mechanicus, and an enameled sign below it announced that the tech priesthood was the supreme authority at Kincher Minehead. The heavy hatch whirred back into its wall slot, revealing a gloomy prep tunnel, lined with empty void suits that swung on their hooks in the breeze. Beyond that, there was a dank scrub room, a darkened office with a padlock on the door, and an empty survey suite with a deactivated chart table.
"Where is everybody?" Medea asked.
We followed the echoing hallways through the complex. Grubby mining equipment was scattered or piled in corners. A small first aid station had been stripped of surgical equipment and stacked with crates of pickled fish. A side room was empty except for hundreds of broken wine bottles. A disused walk-in freezer store exuded the stink of spoiled meat through its open door. Water spattered from the dark, lofty ceilings of some vaults. Chains swung from overhead hoists. Cold, dry breezes gusted down the halls. When the wall speakers boomed, we all started.
"Allied Imperial Minerals, duty rotation in 15 minutes."
The voice was an automatic recording. Nothing stirred in response.
"This is most perturbatory," murmured Amos. "According to Imperial records, Kinchare Minehead is an active concern. Allied Imperial has a workforce of 1,900 running their deep-cast mines, and Ortog Prometheum another 700 at their gypnate quarries, not to mention independent prospectors, ancillary service workers, security, and the personnel of the Adeptus. Minehead is meant to have a population of nearly 3,000.
We had reached a main concourse, a wide thoroughfare lit by overhead lamps, many of which were smashed. Abandoned merchant shops and bars lined either side. "Let's look around," I said. We fanned out. I walked to the north end of the trash-littered concourse and found steps leading down into a wide plaza full of more empty shops and businesses. I heard the whine of an electric motor from down to the left and followed it. Round the corner of a boarded-up canteen, a fat, tired open buggy was pulled up outside the unkempt entrance of a claims registry. I went inside. The floor was covered in spilled, yellowing papers and dented data slates. A snowdrift of used and mouldering ration cartons filled a side door into a filing room. Nail's motion detector clicked and whirred. It projected its display on the inside of my mask's right lens. Motion, the rear office, 8 meters. I edged to the door and peered in, my hand on the grip of the holstered Laz. A long-limbed man in filthy overalls was crouching with his back to me, rummaging through a footlocker. "Hello," I said. He jumped out of his skin, turning and rising in the same frantic motion, then crashed backwards against a row of metal cabinets. His long, gawky face was pale with fear. His hands were raised.
"Oh, crap! Oh, dear God, Emperor! Oh, please! Please!"
"Calm down," I said.
"Who are you? Oh, crap, don't hurt me."
"I'm not going to. My name is Horn. Who are you?"
"Bandelby. Fine Bandelby. Mining superintendent, second class. Ortog Prometheum. Crap, don't hurt me."
"I'm not going to," I repeated firmly. At least the frayed name tag on his dungarees agreed with him. Bandelby F, super, second OP. "Put your hands down," I said. "Why did you think I was going to hurt you?" He lowered his hands and shrugged.
"I didn't. Sort of. I don't know."
He regained a little composure and squinted at me.
"Where do you come from?"
he asked. He was an ugly, lantern-jawed fellow with unkempt, greasy hair and stubble. There was the hint of a raw pink birthmark on the side of his throat. "Off Rock. Just got here. I was wondering why there was no one around."
"Everyone's gone."
"Gone?"
"Gone. Shipped out. Left. Because of the Gravs."
"The Gravs?" I don't know if he was going to answer. My motion tracker suddenly flashed an alert up on my lens, and I wheeled around to find a man standing in the registry's entrance. He was a big man with dark skin and a white stubble of hair and beard. The auto pistol in his right hand was aimed at my face.
"Nice and slow," he said. "Lose the guns. And the mask."
"What's going on? Who's in charge here?"
demanded a voice from outside. It was Amos. The man with the gun glanced outside and then waved me ahead of him. Amos, looking very haughty and dignified, stood in the streetway behind the parked buggy.
"Well, I am Dr. Savine from the Royal Scolam Geologicus on Mendelin. Is this the way Kinchare Minehead greets its guests?"
I was impressed. There was a querulous tone of piqued authority. Amos had acting talents I had never imagined.
"You got papers?"
asked the man with the gun, still covering me. Bandelby had emerged and was watching the exchange.
"Of course," Amos snapped, "and I'll show them to someone in authority."
The man with the gun reached his free hand down into the neck of his mesh-reinforced coat and pulled out a polished silver badge on a neck chain.
Enforcer Khalil, Kincheir Minehead Security Service. I'm the only authority you'll find round here.
Amos tutted and wrapped the tip of his data cane down on the Rock Creek ground. The cane head clicked around and cast a small hologram into the air above it. Identity details, the seal of the Royal Scolum Geographicus, and a slowly revolving 3D scan of Amos's head.
Okay, Doctor,
nodded Khalil.
He gestured to me with a gun. What about this goon?
You think I'd travel out to this misbegotten rock without a bodyguard? This goon is Mr. Horn.
This goon was putting the squeeze on my friend Bandleby.
Amos looked at me sternly.
I've warned you about that, Horn. Damn it! You're not in the Mordian gang wars now.
Amos turned back to Khalil.
He is somewhat enthusiastic. One testosterone stim too many, somewhere along the line. But I needed muscle, not brains, and he was cheaper than a cybermastiff.
Be thankful you can't see my face behind this mask, old friend, I thought.
Okay, but keep him on a leash, said Khalil, holstering his weapon. Let's go to the security station, and you can tell me what the hell you're doing here.
And you can tell me where the hell everyone is, replied Amos.
Khalil nodded and gestured for us to lead the way down the street.
So you don't need me to detonate anyone's skull, Dr. Savine? Said a voice.
Khalil and Bandleby froze. Medea slunk from cover in a shutterway across the street, a Glavian needle pistol held in an unwavering two-handed grip and aimed at Khalil's head.
Crap!
Bandleby gasped.
My pilot,
Amos said, deadpan. He flapped a hand sidelong at Medea.
No, Cora, we're all friends here now.
Medea grinned and winked at Khalil, sliding her weapon away inside her flight suit.
Had you called, Enforcer Khalil?
Khalil gave her a murderous glare and led us towards the security station. The station was on the second floor of a round building on the corner of the deserted plaza. A guardrail ran at hip height around the office, and beyond that, inwardly raked windows permitted a wide view down into the plaza area. Khalil thumbed a wall control that reduced the tinting in the glass and made the room a little brighter. Seats were arranged around a central circular workstation, above which glowed a holo display. Empty ration pouches and ale bottles cluttered the surfaces of the workstation, and handwritten notes and memos had been taped along the edges of the console. Around the room were couch seats with splitting upholstery and piles of junk. A door in the rear led through to an armory and a ready room. The air was humid and smelled of sweat and unwashed clothes. Khalil took off his mesh jacket and tossed it onto a couch. He wore a grubby vest that showed off his physique and the Imperial Guard tattoos on his upper arms. His badge of office hung down over his chest like an athlete's medal.
Get him refreshment, he told Bandleby.
The miner began swishing each of the ale bottles standing on the cowling of the workstation to find one with some contents left.
Fresh ones, Khalil scolded. And I'm sure the doctor would prefer something softer.
Or harder.
Amasek, if you have it, said Amos.
Ale's fine, smiled Medea, flopping onto a couch and folding her legs up under her. I shook my head. Nothing. Bandleby disappeared. Khalil sat down backwards on one of the workstation chairs so he could fold his arms over the top of the backrest.
Okay, Doctor. What's the story?
I am the head of the metallurgy department at the Royal Skolam. Do you know Mendelin?
Khalil shook his head.
Never been there.
A fine world, a noble world, famed for its academia.
Amos carefully took a seat next to Medea. I stood back by the windows. I could tell Khalil had one eye on me.
We are engaged in a 20-year program commissioned by Archduke Frederick himself to investigate the inner transition qualities of the rarest metals for, well, the applications are classified, actually. The results may improve the industrial health of Mendelin's engine yards. The Archduke is a keen amateur metallurgist. He's the patron of the Royal Skolam, in fact.
Do tell,
murmured Khalil.
Ferridnum is one of the metals to be covered in our program, and this planetoid is one of the nearest sources of it. The Administratum has kindly issued me with a bond to visit Kincheir and obtain samples, and I have letters from the Lord Director of Imperial Allied to inspect the Ferridnum workings. Do you wish to see them?
Khalil waved a dismissive hand.
I also hoped to meet with the tech priests stationed here in order to discuss their understanding of the properties of this precious substance.
You're on a fact-finding trip.
A research mission, said Amos.
Bandleby returned with 3 ales and an enamel cup. He carried them on a dented locker door, which he was using as a tray.
"It's not good stuff," he told Amos, handing him the cup. "Just ration issue grade."
Amos sipped it without the hint of a shudder.
"Rough but bracing," he announced.
Khalil took his bottle and tugged a swig from the neck.
"You've had a wasted journey, I'm afraid," he said. "Emperor knows what Imperial Allied were playing at when they gave you those letters. They must know their people have pulled out."
"Explain," I said. Khalil shot me a glance.
"This rock's been worked pretty consistently for the last 9 centuries. It's hazardous work, but the rewards are great. As you said, Kincher's a rich source of many metals that are very hard to come by."
He took another swig.
"These last 20 years, the authorities here have been getting worried about the conditions. The gravity distortions. Kincher moving ever closer into the grav fields of Pimbile. Reckoning was that the place would be unviable in another 80-90 years. Imperial Allied and Ortog stepped up their work, trying to strip out as much as they could before Kincher passed into a gravity envelope that would make it untouchable for the next few 1,000 years. The Indie prospectors, too. They came flocking. Regular old-fashioned ore rush the past few years."
"So, what happened?" asked Medea.
"The gravs," said Bandleby. He was clearing a seat for himself on one of the paper-stacked couches. He looked up and saw Medea's quizzically raised eyebrow.
"Gravity sickness,"
he said at once, in response to her unasked question. He scratched the birthmark on his neck, nervously. He'd been keeping a keen eye on her. She was probably the first woman he'd seen in a while. Khalil was more composed.
"Gravity sickness," Bandleby continued. "White distemper, lead head. The gravs, you know.
Chronic gravitesthesia, also known as Masber's syndrome. A progressive disorder caused by exotic gravitational flux. Symptoms include paranoia, loss of coordination, bursts of anxiety or rapture, memory loss, hallucination, and sometimes in extremis, homicidal urges. The condition is usually accompanied by myasthenia gravis, osteochondritis, osteoporosis, scoliosis, and leukemia," Amos finished.
Khalil widened his eyes.
"I thought you were a doctor of metals, doctor, not a medicae."
"I am. But gravity, that invisible power, is a fundamental part of the life of all elements, so I take an interest in it."
"Yeah, well, the prediction said Kincher might become unviable due to gravity in 90 years. But the human body is softer than a hunk of mineral ore. The gravs first showed up about 2 years back. Workers getting sick. A few cases of violence and insanity. Then we realized what was going on. Imperial Allied pulled out 9 months ago. Ortog, 7.
"It's ironic," Amos said. "Kincher is mineral-rich precisely because of the exotic gravities it has been subjected to in its billion-year life. Elements have been transmuted and rearranged here in ways that may be unique. Kincher is a precious philosopher's stone, my friends, an alchemist's dream, and now mankind cannot benefit from its gifts for precisely the same reason they exist in the first place."
"Yeah, Doc, ironic is what it is,"
said Bandleby, knocking back his ale.
"That doesn't explain why you're still here," I said. "Skeleton crew," said Khalil, in a tone that said it was none of my business. "The Adeptus Mechanicus pulled out too, about 3 months ago. But one of theirs stayed behind, some sort of vital research that had to be finished, and we were ordered to stay behind and keep Kincher Minehead open until he finished." I moved round and looked out of the station windows. The plaza was empty of everything except trash. "And how many is we, Enforcer?"
"Service crew of 20. I'm in charge. All volunteers."
"The Tech Lords promised us triple pay,"
Bandleby told Medea, clearly trying to impress her.
"Gee whiz,"
she smiled. "Where are the others? The other 18, I pressed. Khalil got up off his chair and tossed his empty bottle at an overflowing litter basket in the corner. It bounced off and broke on the floor.
"Around about. This is a big place. What you see is just the tip, like a... what's it called, those frozen lumps of water they have in the sea on some planets?"
"Iceberg?"
Medea suggested.
"Yeah, like one of those. 90% of Kincher Minehead is subsoil. There's a crap lot of space to patrol, maintain, and keep ticking over."
"You're in Vox contact with the rest of the skeleton crew?"
"We keep in touch. Some I don't see for weeks.
This tech priest, the one who remained, Amos said. Where is he?
Khalil shrugged.
Gone rockside. Into the castes and the mines. I've not seen him for 2 months.
When do you expect him back?
Amos said, as if it didn't matter.
Khalil shrugged again. Never.
What was his name? I asked, turning to look directly into the enforcer's dark eyes.
Bure, he said. Why?
Well, this is all most perturbatory, Amos blurted, rising from his seat. The Archduke will be very put out. It has cost a deal of time and money to venture this mission, Mr. Khalil. Since we've come this far, I'd like to do what little I can.
Like what, Doctor?
Obtain some samples, inspect the Feridnum workings, study the mineralogy ledges.
I don't know. Kinchair Mineheads meant to be closed up now, officially.
Would it really be too much to ask? I'm sure the Lord Director of Imperial Allied would be pleased if you cooperated with me. Pleased enough to proffer a bonus if I made a report to him.
Khalil frowned.
Uh-huh. What are we talking about?
A day to overview the ledgers and a mineralogy database. Perhaps another day to examine the sample archives from the quarries. And, well, how long would it take to arrange a visit to the Feridnum face? The latest one.
I call my staff in, maybe 2 days round trip.
So, excellent. 4 days total, and we'll be gone.
I don't know, said Bandleby. Don't you want me hanging around for a few days? Asked Medea, reading Bandleby's body language as acutely as any trained inquisitor, and revealing as much latent acting ability as Amos.
I shouldn't allow it, said Khalil. This place is off limits now. Company orders. You didn't ought to stay here.
You stay here, I pointed out.
I get danger money, he said.
And you could get more, said Amos. I promise you, I'll speak highly of your cooperation to the Lord Director of Imperial Allied and my old friends at the Adeptus. They would reward well anyone assisting a servant of the Archduke.
Get me an ale,
Khalil told Bandleby. He looked at us, rolling his chin.
I'll talk to my staff, see what they think.
Good, good, said Amos. I do hope we can reach an arrangement. In the meantime, we'll need quarters. Are there spare beds here?
Kinchair's been full of empty beds since the workforce moved out, Bandleby told Medea through a nasty smile.
Find them a hab, Khalil told the miner. I'll get on to the crew.
Something's not right, I said, pulling off my mask and tossing it onto the floor.
These cots are really rather cozy,
Amos replied, adjusting the tension of his exoframe and reclining on the mattress. We were in a dry, stuffy rec room above the miners' welfare. The artificial lamplight from the plaza outside slanted in through sagging blinds. Bandleby had provided 3 metal cots with subsiding mattresses and sleeping bags that smelled like they had been used to sieve motor fuel and cabbage.
You always worry,
Medea said, uninhibitedly shrugging off her flight suit and kicking it into a corner. She was clad in nothing but her vest and briefs and her shoulder holster, which she was now unclasping. Amos rolled over and looked the other way.
It's my job to worry. And stop getting undressed, we're not finished.
Medea looked at me and rebuckled her gun rig with a dark frown.
Okay, my lord and master. What?
What's not right?
I can't quite put my finger on it, I began.
Medea tutted and flopped down on her cot.
Yes, you can, Gregor,
Amos said.
Maybe I can.
Try.
This stuff about the Gravs. Even if the corporations were suckered, it's not like the Adeptus Mechanicus to fail in a prediction.
Any cosmologist would know if Kinchair was entering a gravitation wilderness that would be harmful to humans. They'd know it years in advance. Emperor protect me, stellar objects move far slower and more predictably than human minds.
A good point, said Amos.
And one that you'd already thought of, I'm sure, I said.
Yes,
he confirmed.
Khalil is clearly lying about something.
And you don't think anything's wrong?
Of course I do,
Amos muttered.
But I'm tired.
Get up, I told him brusquely. He sat up. At least we know Bure's still here, I said.
This is the guy we came to find? Medea asked. I nodded.
Magos Bure.
So how do you two know him? A tech priest Magos? Old story, my dear, said Amos. I've got time.
He was a loyal ally of my master, Inquisitor Hapshant, Amos's old boss, I said, cutting to the chase before Amos could get going.
A blast from the past, huh? She grinned. Something like that. Still, it's a long way to come just to catch up with an old friend, she added. Enough, Medea, I said. You don't need to know the particulars yet. Maybe better for you if you don't. She blew a raspberry at me and began to pull her flight suit back on. You tried to reach the SN recently? I asked. My Vox hasn't got the range, she sulked back, fiddling with the zipper. Gravity distortions are too much. We expected that. I could go back to the cutter and use the main caster. I need you here. We need to scare up some answers fast. I want you to sneak Amos down to the Administratum archive and see if you can coax anything out of the data banks, if they're still functioning. While you... I'm going to the annex of the Adeptus Mechanicus. Meet back here in 3 hours. We're looking for any clues, but particularly any traces of Bure's whereabouts. Amos nodded. What if we're challenged? You couldn't sleep. You went for a walk, and you got lost. And if they don't believe me? That's why Medea's going with you, I said. The annex of the Tech Priesthood lay in the western sector of Kinchare Minehead's jumbled maze of pressurized habs and processing sheds, about 2 kilometers from the plaza. At first I hadn't known where I was going, but the tunnels and transit ways were marked with numbered signs and symbol-coded notices, and after a while I found a large etched metal directory map screwed to a pillar beside a bank of dusty public drinking fountains. A twist of the tap on one of the fountains produced nothing but a dry rasp. Approaching the annex, the whitewashed tunnel walls were overpainted with dark red stripes, and there were numerous caution signs and warnings that demanded correct papers and identities on pain of death. Still, the whole place was bare and empty, and thick with dust and litter. At the end of the red-striped access tunnel, the vast adamantite blast gates to the annex stood open. There was an eerie silence. The annex was a colossal tower of hewn rock dressed in red steel, filling a side chimney of the crater that housed Kinchare's minehead. A sealed glass dome covered the paved yard between the blast gates and the annex, and the building itself rose up beyond the glass to the top of the crater rim. High above, I could see the blue rock and the starlit void beyond. Meteors streaked overhead. The doorway of the annex was a giant portal, taller than 3 men, framed by thick Doric columns of black lucellite. Above it leered the graven image of the machine god, its eyes clearly carved in such a way that they would flare ominously with gas burn-offs piped in from the mines. They were cold and dead now. And the burnished metal doors of the portal were open. I stepped inside. Fine sand covered the floor of the Grand Prothyron. Dust motes glittered in the bars of light, spearing into the high hallway through deadlights up near the ribbed roof. Both walls were entirely panelled with banks of codifiers and matriculators, all dormant and powered down. Crescents of dust bearded every single switch and dial. I knew at once this was a bad sign. The tech priests treasured machines more than anything else. If they had evacuated, as Khalil described, there was no way they would have left such a wealth of technology here, especially as each unit was clearly designed to slot out of its alcove in the black marble walls. The chamber beyond the Prothyron was a veritable chapel, a cathedral dedicated to the god machine, the Master of Mars. The floor was creamy travertine slabs, so tightly laid not even a sheet of paper could be slipped between the stones. The chapel itself was triapsidal, with walls of smooth, cold lucellite and a roof 30 meters above my head. There was yet more precious technology arranged in 6 concentric circles of intricate brass workstations around a central plinth. All of it was dead and unpowered. I crossed the chamber towards the plinth, painfully aware of how loud my footsteps rang back from the emptiness. Chilly starlight shone down through an opaean in the centre of the roof, directly above the massive grandiorite plinth. The huge, severed head of an ancient warlord titan hung above the plinth where the starlight shafted down. I realised that nothing supported the head. No cables, no platform, no scaffolding. It simply hung in the air. As I got close to the plinth, gazing up at the Titan's face, my hair pricked. Static, or something like it, bristled the atmosphere. Some invisible harnessed force, perhaps gravity or magnetics, certainly something beyond my understanding, was at play here, suspending the multiple tons of the machine skull. It was a silent marvel, characteristic of the tech priesthood. Even with the power shut down, their miracles endured. On one workstation console, a brass frame full of intermeshed iron cogs, silvered wires and glass valves. I saw a length of canvas-sleeved neural hose, one end plugged into the display, the other frayed and severed. That was more than just a case of someone leaving in a hurry. Over the years, my dealings with the Adeptus Mechanicus had been few. They were a law unto themselves, like the Astartes, and only a fool would meddle with their power. Bure, Magos-geared Bure, had been my closest contact with them. Without the priesthood of Mars, the technologies of the Imperium would wither and perish, and without their ceaseless endeavors, no new wonders would ever be added to mankind's might. Yet here I stood, unmolested and uninvited, in the middle of one of their inner sanctums. My Voxlink pipped. A voice, Medea's, badly distorted by gravity flux, said, "Aegis wishes Thorn. My half-life d—" It cut off. "Thorn attends Aegis," I said. Nothing. "Thorn attends Aegis, the whisperless void." Still nothing. What little I had caught of Medea's brief message troubled me. Half-life was a glossier code word that could be used in phrases to disclose an important discovery or indicate a grave predicament. But what troubled me far more was the fact she had cut off. My reply, if she had heard it, indicated her transmission had been incomplete or garbled. I waited a full minute, then another. Without warning, my Vox pipped quickly 3 times. Medea had test-keyed her transmitter in a non-vocal code form that indicated she couldn't talk and that I should stand by. I brushed the thin skin of dust off one dead work desk and gazed at the worn, rune-marked keyboard and the small display screens of thick, convex glass, wondering what secrets I could possibly unlock from it. Little, I decided. Amos, who frankly knew more than it was healthy to know, might have a chance. He had worked closely with Bure years before, and I fancied he had more experience of the mysterious tech priests and their ways than he cared to admit. My motion tracker suddenly clicked around, and I tensed, pulling my stub-nosed las pistol. The tracker's display on my mask's right lens indicated a movement or contact 17 paces to my left, but even as I turned, it flashed up more. Multiple contacts, all around, coming so fast that they overlapped and utterly confused the tracker for a moment. The lens display showed a default 000000 for a second, as it struggled to compute the vectors, and then it scrolled a tight column of coordinates in front of my eye. But by then, I knew what it had sensed. The sanctum was coming to life. In swift succession, each workstation chattered into action, cogs whirring, valves glowing, screens lighting, pistons hissing. Pneumatic gas pumps exhaled and communique flasks began to pop and whiz through the network of elegant glass and brass message tubes that ran between the consoles and up the walls. Several desks projected small hologram images above their hololith hubs. 3-dimensional strata maps, spectroscopy graphs, sonar readings and oscillating waveforms. Powerful underlights ignited on the plinth top beneath the floating head of the Titan and threw its features into malevolent relief. I sank down behind one of the stations, which vibrated and chattered against my back. The sudden, inexplicable life was daunting and alarming. Somewhere close by, one particular machine was rattling and repeating like an old machine gun on full auto. As suddenly as it had started, the life died away. Stations fell silent and their lights went out. The throb of power leaked away into the darkness. The Titan's underlights dimmed and died. One by one, the holograms extinguished and the desks fell dormant. The churring of cogs and servos and the throb of valves ebbed into stillness. The last sound to go was that auto-gun racket. It continued for a good few seconds after everything else had stopped. Then it too ceased, abruptly. The chapel was then as dark and quiet as it had been when I first entered. I got to my feet. There had been no power in this place, no feeding source. What had started and woken the machines? It had to have been some signal from outside. Using common sense and guesswork, I went around the circle of stations nearest to me, hunting for the one that had chattered like a stubber. The most likely candidate was a bulky desk that seemed to have external and general gain Vox functions. But its keys were dead to my touch. On a whim, I got down on my knees and peered behind the desk. There were fixings where a basket hopper should have been sitting to catch the printouts. The hopper was missing. The sheaf of printout had fallen down into the dust under the desk. I scooped the sheaf out. It was about 9 meters long, punch cut by the printer's jaws into shorter sections. Clearly this desk had been disgorging printouts for some time without anyone around to collect them. The sections at the bottom of the spool were beginning to yellow. I looked them over, but they meant nothing. Tabulated columns of machine code in close, regular bands. Carefully, I laid them out on the travertine floor and rolled them tightly into a thick scroll. I was nearly finished when my vox pipped.
Aegis wishes Thorn, by half-light disabused, in administratum by heart. Scales fall from eyes, multifarious, the grasp of changelings. Patton Thimble advised.
Patton Thimble acknowledged. Thorn arising by heart. Medea's words had told me all I needed to know. They had found something in the administratum, and they needed me back swiftly. There was danger from chaos all around. I should trust no one. I holstered my las pistol and tucked the printout scroll into my waistband. As I ran out of the annex and down the red-striped tunnel, I tugged my combat shotgun out over my shoulder and racked the slide.